Tout de suite sur E-Radio, retrouvez Île d'Europe, une émission présentée par Boris Mejuri.
Déconfiné sur l'île. Et bienvenue à Île d'Europe, version aménagée avec les moyens de bord. Pendant les déconfinements, c'est en temps de crise que les décisions se font plus urgentes. Mais pourquoi les personnes intelligentes prennent les mauvaises décisions pour survivre dans un continent qui bouge? Nous en parlons aujourd'hui avec David Robson, écrivain scientifique anglais, auteur du livre The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Make Dumb Mistakes, publié en France par Fayard avec le titre Pourquoi l'intelligence rend idiot. Hi David.
Hey, thanks for having me.
One scientific article after another, you read about the lives of so many smart people and you observed a lot of them had a poor decision ability, for example, in their personal life. So you started to join the dots.
You know, I was inspired to write this book because during my job as a science journalist, I would come across these great minds who were kind of, when you dug around their kind of private lives or their private beliefs, you actually found out that they often acted in quite bizarre ways. So one of my favorite examples was this man called Paul Frampton, who was a wonderful physicist, and in fact he inspired a lot of the experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. But later in life he started online dating, and he got talking to this person who claimed to be a Czech glamour model, and they eventually agreed to meet up in La Paz, Bolivia, where she said she was going to a photo shoot, but you know, she didn't turn up to the meeting, and she sent him a message telling him that he had left her own luggage in the hotel and asked if he could pick it up for her and take it across the border to Argentina. Now, he did that. He seemed completely unaware of any risks that might be involved, and he was subsequently arrested for carrying 2 kilograms of cocaine through the airport. So this was someone who was amazing.
So a Czech model, meet me in Bolivia, but I'm not there, so take my luggage, take it to Argentina, there is the cocaine inside. All right, everything is fine.
Exactly. This was an amazing mind, but he just didn't seem to understand the kind of risks that might be involved in these kinds of interactions. He seemed oblivious to the to anything that might have kind of stood in the way of his real wish for this relationship to work. And that kind of story just got me thinking, really, what do we mean by intelligence? How much does education actually help us to think in a more rational and objective kind of way?
So what have you found, David?
Often intelligence doesn't correlate with measures of rationality or good decision making. You know, it doesn't really correlate well with emotional intelligence, and sometimes actually intelligence can really backfire. And I kind of like to think it's a bit like Descartes said when he claimed that the greatest minds have the greatest virtues as well as the greatest vices. And he said that you could go along the right path slowly, or you could kind of veer off that path very quickly. And actually then the kind of faster you're moving, the kind of more you're veering off the correct route. And that's really what I see with intelligence, actually, is that if you apply it correctly, then it can get you to the kind of place that you want to be.
So this book is about a light shed on everyday decision-making process that we all do.
Absolutely. So a lot of the book is really looking at how we can avoid this intelligence trap that I've discussed. And maybe it would be helpful if I just give one example. So what we find, and I think this was very true with the story of Paul Frampton that I just discussed, was that if we have a very strong emotion about a situation, then that emotion can kind of redirect our intelligence and the way we apply it, so that we really use our intelligence just to justify our own decision making rather than to look at a situation objectively. Now, there are good techniques to avoid that, and one of the very simple techniques is this process called self-distancing, and that's where you try to kind of step out of your own shoes and look at your situation from afar. One way of doing that is to kind of visualize yourself almost as a fly on the wall. Another very popular and useful technique is to just talk to yourself in the third person. So if I was, say I had like a problem with my work or whatever, I would start by saying, well, David feels frustrated because his colleague acted in this way. And that small linguistic shift actually just mutes your emotions slightly.
So you propose a shift in the narrator's voice.
That's exactly it. And what we find is that actually people who do that then do tend to perform a lot better on measures of rational decision making.
From self-distancing to social distancing, and this brings us to this coronavirus crisis, David. How would you define the decision making process that people in charge are doing in this period during this current pandemic?
There's one element of my book that I think is really important here, and that is that the best decision makers have a high tolerance of ambiguity or uncertainty. So whereas some people like to come to very quick snap judgments and to feel that they've understood a situation very quickly, the better decision makers actually embrace more they recognize the uncertainty, and they can kind of hold lots of ideas in their head at one time without necessarily going with one or another. And I think that has been crucial in our response to coronavirus, because there is just such a lot of uncertainty about this illness. You know, it's only emerged very quickly. We don't have very good data yet on even something as basic as the mortality rate. You know, there's lots of conflicting readings there. And so I think what we have to do is not jump to conclusions. We have to respond as quickly as necessary, but we also have to be flexible in our thinking and not become married to one particular strategy or one particular theory. Now, in the past, and I mentioned this in my book, Angela Merkel seems to have been a very good leader in this regard, in that people around her often say she has a very high tolerance of ambiguity, that she integrates lots of pieces of information and tries to see the nuances in a situation before coming to a decision. And I think, like, you can see that a little with her response to the coronavirus outbreak. And so I think that's what we should be looking for in our leaders in the UK, in France, really across the world, is people who are responding rapidly to the outbreak, but are still keeping an open mind and are willing to change their opinions and update them with the evidence.
So let's keep our mind open. We will be back right after the music break here on Il de Rob with David Robson.
I've been spitting in the wind. I chanced a foolish grin and dribbled on my chin. And now the ground shifts beneath my feet. The faces that I greet never know my name. Just give me something, I'll take nothing. Just give me something, I'll take nothing. Now the drought is crippled by
badly drawn boy spitting in the wind.
Île d'Europe sur Euradio.
Et nous revoilà Île d'Europe ici aujourd'hui pour parler d'un bouquin qui s'appelle Pourquoi l'intelligence rend idiot, et on est avec l'auteur David Robson. We are talking about why smart people make dumb decisions. We have just mentioned Angela Merkel as somebody that is able to handle a great deal of ambiguity and uncertainty, as it is the case with her management of the COVID-19 crisis. But isn't there the risk of being called incoherent if we change our mind, David?
Well, you know, I find this very interesting because I'd heard that there's this verb in Germany, to Merkel, which isn't flattering. It means that you're kind of really undecisive, partly because there's this view of Angela Merkel. And I would say that's actually a problem with our culture, that we kind of see we see the change of opinion as a sign of foolishness rather than what I think it is actually a very rational response, that we update our opinions when we have new pieces of evidence. And actually, that's supported by the scientific literature.
But we still have a lot of fascination for leaders that are able to decide fast, the man of the providence.
This view that, like, you have to make decisions rapidly, certainly in the UK, I think that's kind of embedded within our education system. And if you just think of a class full of children and the teacher's in front of all of these children and asks a question, and the children have to put up their hands to answer. Now, if you're the first person to put up your hand, you're more likely to be picked to answer the question, and you're rewarded for that. You're praised for being a quick thinker. But the fact is that there could have been other children who were a bit more hesitant and maybe were forming more nuanced opinions, but were never given the chance to speak. And that's just one example, but I think this is quite common in the UK and the US, that actually we're rewarded for quick thinking when slow thinking can actually be more effective.
Well, the education system, you said. Since World War II, we had this promising idea, free education for all would prevent a new wave of violence and death to hit Europe. But populism and corruption are flourishing again, thanks to voters that have been studying in this free and accessible education system.
I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think it's the most important implication of the findings of my book. And so let me answer that by first talking about this phenomenon called the my side bias. And that is a cognitive bias. And it essentially is the fact that you apply your intelligence in a very one-sided way. So you look for the information that supports your point of view. And when you come across a piece of information that or evidence that disagrees with what you're saying, you just apply your intelligence to kind of poke holes in that piece of evidence and to dismiss it. So you're building a very one-sided picture that only supports what you want to believe. Now, what we see when psychologists have studied children and adolescents and then adults throughout the education system from middle school to university is that people, as they progress through education, become no better at looking for the opposite side of the argument. But what they do become better at is finding the pieces of evidence to support their own point of view. So in that sense, they're actually becoming more biased as they go through education. And I think that really speaks to a big problem with our education systems at the moment, that they're not really teaching critical or rational thinking. They're kind of teaching us to be really good arguers, very persuasive arguers, in a way that we can always find, we have a gut reaction and then we can support our point of view, but we're not really very good at actually seeing the truth or the nuances in a situation. And that kind of thinking, I think, really lends itself to these populist leaders, because they can evoke very strong emotions and then their followers can become very polarized and very resistant to any criticism of those leaders. So what we see is the population just growing further and further apart, and politics becoming much more about emotions rather than a reasoned, rational response. And that's exactly the opposite of what we would hope to arise from education.
Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you. It's completely my pleasure.
Et c'est tout pour aujourd'hui. C'était David Robson, auteur du livre Pourquoi l'intelligence rend idiot, publié par Fayard. Au revoir.
Boris Medjourin vous a présenté Île d'Europe. Retrouvez cette émission en podcast sur euradio.fr.